Hello and welcome to our Institute for Nutritional Endocrinology module on fats as a part of the macronutrients module. And it's about fat. This video is about fat structure and function. And fats are like these misunderstood and maligned creatures. And I want to really clarify a lot of the value of fats in our body and the functions that they have, the structure that they take on, and how you can help your clients to balance their fats and optimize their functioning. But before we begin, as usual, all the information that I share is from my experience and my expertise. It's not to replace a one-on-one relationship with a medical professional. It's not medical advice. It's sharing. And the same when you're sharing with your clients about fats and how they work in their body, just make sure that if they're under the care of a medical professional, that they're checking in and making sure that they're not doing anything that's out of alignment with what the care that they're being offered. Our macronutrients module is composed of four main pieces. Water, which a lot of people don't even think of as a nutrient, but it's a very critical nutrient, and we've already been through that. Fat, protein, and carbohydrate. Fat, protein, and carbohydrate are what provide the calories in your diet and in your clients' diets. Those are called the macronutrients. The vitamins and minerals and antioxidants are called the micronutrients. They don't have caloric value or energy value in the system, but they sure have some mighty important functions. So within the macronutrients, we've already given you a talk on water. The current one is on fat. Then we're going to go to protein and carbohydrates. So what you're going to learn in this presentation is a number of things. First of all, the importance of fat in the body. Again, like I said earlier, fat has gotten a bad rap, like low fat, no fat, bad fat. We're going to learn about bad fats, good fats, fats that support structure and function, fats that reduce the viability of structure and function, fats that interfere with. And I'm going to teach you the basic underlying components of fats so that you can understand how to counsel your patients and clients about how to use fats in their diets. So we're going to look at categories of fats. And there's different categories. Now, I won't spill the beans now. I'll tell you in a little bit. We're going to look at the chemical structure of fats. And for those of you who love to geek out on biochemistry like I do, you're going to love this piece. For those of you who don't, I'm really simplifying it down so it demystifies fats, as well as in future modules, the proteins and the carbohydrates. So the chemical structure is really important to understand. And again, it takes away some of the mystique and the mystery. We're going to talk about the omega classification of polyunsaturated fats and also monounsaturated fats. So really, the omega classification of unsaturated fats. And we'll talk about what saturated fats are versus unsaturated fats and really take away the cloud of mystery about omega-3, omega-6, omega-9. What does that really mean? And we're going to go to, guess what? The chemical structure in order to do that. We're going to look at the omega fats naming conventions. And it's really not a naming convention that necessarily you're going to see on bottles and labels. But if you go out and you start to do research on particular diseases or conditions or food components, and you see the way that fats, the nomenclature that's used, I want to demystify what those, you know, the colon, this and that and the other thing and the numbers. So I want to make sure that you understand that. We're going to look at essential fats versus non-essential fats. And why non-essential fats are really not, they're not that they're not essential to human functioning. It means that related to what is given in the diet, the ability to either make fats, which are the non-essential fats, and the essential fats. But truth of the matter is, you need to have enough essential fats in order to have the raw materials to make what's called the non-essentials. And we'll see that those have very important functioning as well as the essentials. We're going to look at the refining and processing of fats, what that actually does to the chemical structure and to the function. So let's take a look at the various places that fats are important in the body. Fats are not just the thing to be avoided at all costs. Fats have very, very important functions in the body. Did you know? You probably know that a big part of the brain is fat, but really it's estimated to be more than half, approximately 60% fat. In the brain, and the fat in the brain helps to protect the neurons, to helps to protect and speed up the transmission of the neurons. And did you know that 25% of the cholesterol is in the brain? So we talk about cholesterol being the bad guy, when in fact it's really not. It's excess cholesterol and oxidized cholesterol that's really the problem. But cholesterol in general is a precursor to the hormones, the steroid hormones in the body, and also makes up about 25% of the brain. It's the precursors of the hormones, the adrenals and the sex hormones, what's called the steroid hormones, and we'll look at those in detail. Also important for the regulation of blood pressure. Did you know that the cell membranes are mostly fat? And I always tell people, you wear your fat. So if you eat good, wholesome fats that have not been oxidized, that are really good structurally, and they become your cell membranes, then your cell membranes can really be giving and taking of nutrients and wastes appropriately. But when you eat fats, or your client is eating fats that have been rancid, oxidized, highly processed, those fats become the cell membranes, and then the functioning of those cell membranes is not good, and that's what leads to toxicity and disease. Your myelin sheaths are fat. Myelin sheaths are a coating around the neurons, which makes it so that you can think, move your foot, and your foot moves instantaneously, even though the thought happened in your head. And the foot is way down. It could be as much as 6 or 6.5 feet down. For many of us, it's about 5.5 feet down, right? A fully grown adult woman is somewhere a little bit less than 5.5 feet. That's a long way to go. And it happens in a millisecond. And when people have problems with myelin sheaths, as in the disease called multiple sclerosis, which is a demyelinating disease, then they don't have that luxury that we have of thinking, move your foot and it moves. That function is every step is challenging because it's a slow process to get the signal from the head to the brain, from the brain to the foot to move it. So that's why another reason fats are super important. Your hair and your skin need fat. You ever see people with really dry hair and skin, flaky scalp? You're going to see those when you practice. And they need fats, especially essential fats, to have that fluidity and that moisture. Immune system needs fat. Fats are important for the inflammatory cascades, which we look at in a video that follows this video. And finally, fat, especially dietary fat, is going to improve the absorption of fat-soluble vitamins. A lot of folks go on these low-fat, no-fat diets, and what they don't realize is that that's going to impair the uptake of vitamin A, and the conversion from beta-carotene to vitamin A, and the uptake of D, should you be taking it liquid orally, and of E, so, and K. Those are the fat-soluble vitamins. And we'll go into a lot more about detail about those vitamins in another segment. So let's look at the importance of fats in the body a little bit further. And this is a study that was done on the absorption, the conversion of the beta-carotene to vitamin A. Beta-carotene is a preform, it's a pro-vitamin A. The body has to convert, taking two beta-carotenes and convert them into one molecule of vitamin A. Beta-carotene is abundant in our food supply, and abundant in green leafy vegetables and lots of your rainbow kind of vegetables. But this was a study that looked at a cup of fresh avocado was added to a salad consisting of romaine lettuce, spinach, and carrots. And what happened was it increased the carotenoids from this salad between 200 and 400% just by adding a little fat. And that avocado could have been cashew butter, it could have been macadamia nuts, it could have been sunflower seeds, hemp seeds, chia seeds, flax oil, coconut oil, could have been any number of those things. This particular study looked at avocado, which of course is delicious. So let's get down to the meat and potatoes, if you will, of dietary fats, the categories of fats. And I'm sure you've heard of these before. You probably understand, at least to an extent, what these are. But we've got saturated fats, monounsaturated fats, and polyunsaturated fats. And just by looking at those words, you might be able to guess what that means. But if you don't really understand the science behind it, you don't really get it. and to just think, oh yeah, saturated fats are bad and polyunsaturated fats are good, is actually a misconception. Because some saturated fats can be really good for you, and many polyunsaturated fats can be really bad for you. And when you throw the balance out of whack with omegas on the polyunsaturated sides, then you really get into trouble. And you'll get there. We're gonna talk about those omegas and how they affect. And then we have monounsaturated fats. And I'm not going to explain to you what each of these kinds are, because I'd rather do the picture. A picture is worth a thousand words. But the lists of foods that have saturated fats, significant amounts of saturated fats, would be meat and dairy, butter, cheese, ghee, eggs, coconut, and palm. Okay, a little bit of saturated fat in things like cashews and macadamia nuts, but the predominant sources are the ones that I just listed. Monounsaturated fats, the ones we think of the most, are olives. But macadamia nuts are very high in monounsaturated fats, as well as cashews, hazelnuts, avocado, sesame seeds, pecans, and almonds. And they have a chart that shows you the exact amounts and percentages of these. So if you are looking to get balance in someone, there's ways that you can do it by helping them to choose, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, less of this, less of that. And finally, the polyunsaturates are abundant in nuts and seeds, grains and vegetables, legumes, and fish. Okay, so you can see that most of the mono and the polys are in your plant-based foods. Most of the saturates are in your animal-based foods, but there is some crossover. So let's look at fatty acids. It's a picture of a fatty acid, a kind of a diagram of it. But fatty acids are the building blocks of fats. So when we look at omega-3s and omega-6s, and when we look at a long, big fat molecule, it's broken up to a variety of fatty acids. So, okay, let's see. So fatty acids, carboxylic acid with a long carbon chain. What does that mean? Carboxylic acid is a COOH, and we'll look at a picture of it in a second. And then we have a long string of carbons with hydrogens hanging off of them. And I'll go through the picture of it so you can see exactly what it means to be a saturated fat, an unsaturated fat, and a polyunsaturated fat, and how that affect the effect that that has on these carbon bonds. They differ in length. So when you see some of the nomenclature of fats, you may see that, say, a fat is like a C, which would be the number of carbons, 22, and oftentimes the C is left off, it's just inferred, colon, 1:9. Okay, that would be a fat that has 22 carbons, one double bond, and that double bond is on the ninth carbon, between the ninth and the tenth, I believe. Okay, and we'll look at some pictures. Most fatty acids have between 10 and 20, but there are several that are called long chain fats, like EPA and DHA, which you may have heard of, that are long chain fats that go up to 22 and 24 carbons. Most have an even number of carbons, and there are a couple of exceptions. Linoleic acid, which is an omega-6 fatty acid, would be listed as 18 or CC18 colon 2, which means that there's two double bonds in there. So it's polyunsaturated. Unsaturated means how all of the bonds in the saturated fats are single bonds, which means that every single bond there can be is saturated with carbon. Every carbon has its full share of hydrogens hanging off of it. For every bond that it could have, it has. Whereas the double bonds mean that there's two bonds between two carbons, and then that number of those relates to whether it's a polyunsaturated or a saturated. So linoleic is 18:2, which means it has two double bonds, two unsaturated bonds, 18 carbons total, and then that N-6 means it's an omega-6. Sometimes those would be listed as 18:2:6. Different nomenclatures, different locations. Okay? The first double bond is at the sixth carbon from the methyl end. So we have a carbon chain, we have a methyl group on one, which is CH3, and then we have a carboxyl group on the other, which is COOH. And like I said, a picture says a thousand words. Let's look at them. Okay. So this is a picture. We have saturated, polyunsaturated, monounsaturated cores in the middle. And on the end, we have what's common to all of those. On the left-hand side, we have a carboxylic group, which is a carbon, a double bond to one oxygen, single bond to another oxygen, and then a hydrogen. And it's often listed as COOH, a carboxylic group or carboxyl group. On the other end, we have a methyl group. And if you've been doing any studying at all in the genetics, genomics area, methylation is very, very popular these days. People are understanding what that is. And all methylation really means is adding a methyl group, a CH3, to a particular chemical structure. So if you look at the top, that's a saturated fat. You'll see that between every carbon, there is one single bond. And then above and below is a bond to a hydrogen. Okay, so every single one of those bonds is saturated, and that's why it's called saturated. This is just a little snippet, because most of these are going to be, like I said, between 12 and 20 and up to 24 carbons. So this is just to show you. So that saturated fat would have this carboxylic group on the one side. It would have the methyl group on the other, and it'd have this string of carbons in the middle, all of which have their full potential of hydrogens attached. Polyunsaturated fat is a fat that does not have all single bonds between its carbon. It doesn't have hydrogens on every single carbon, meaning it's saturated. It has several carbons that do not have hydrogen because they're double bonded to each other. And we see that here in the picture where the number one is. That's a double bond. Got it? And then the other one, number two, is a double bond carbon to carbon, which means that for every double bond, there's two less hydrogens. So this is a polyunsaturated fat. And we'll go into the omega-3 designation in a moment and the omega-6 and tell you what that really means. Really what it means is the placement of the first double bond. A monounsaturated fat, on the other hand, just has one double bond. So it's two less hydrogens than its saturated counterpart. So let's go into a little bit more detail about these fats and what they are and what they do and what they look like. So here's a full-blown saturated fat laid out. This particular saturated fat has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 carbons. So it would be designated as C16, or sometimes just 16. And then it's got, for every carbon, it's got one hydrogen, two hydrogens, which would make it 32, plus it's got two more on the ends. So it's got 34. So it would be C16H34. And then how many oxygens? O2. So if we were naming this, we would name it just basically C16, because we know it's saturated, therefore we don't have to know how many double bonds and where those bonds are located. What's listed here are some of the most common saturated fats. There's dozens of them, if even 100. I've marked in red or kind of orangey the ones that you might see more often, like butyric acid, which is found in butter, and it's also an important one that's in the gut colon, in the large intestine, which helps with gut flora. Caprylic acid, you may have heard of. It's part of coconut, and it actually is very useful as an antifungal. And a lot of times you'll see caprylic acid used as an antifungal with people with candida overgrowth. Lauric acid is another one that's in your coconut. Coconut is a really powerful source of these saturated fats. And lauric acid has two really big roles, amongst others. One is that it's very potently antiviral, and the other is that it helps with the conversion of short chain omega-3s to long chain, and we'll get more into that in our video on inflammation. And then there's myristic acid, which is a C14, and that's also found in coconut, and it has been found to profoundly improve the conversion of omega-3 short fats, which are found in the vegetable kingdom, like alpha-linolenic acid, into the longer chains, which are EPA and DHA. And we'll show you these in a little bit on some of the charts. So those are the main ones. Another one on the right-hand side that you may see a bunch of times is stearic acid. And that's the third one down. It's a C18. Stearic acid is used a lot of times as a lubricant, basically, in supplements. And it's a binder, filler, that's in some of the supplements because it's kind of thick and gooey and it helps to lubricate. Now let's look at the unsaturated fats. So we have two classes. Monounsaturated means they have one double bond. And polyunsaturated means they have two or more double bonds. And some of the most common ones, which is pictured here on the slide, or the most common one that you hear about, is oleic acid, which is has 18 carbons. So the 18:1 means it's 18:1 means that it's got the one double bond. And we didn't write that there where the bond was, because just about all of these, I think all of these are actually omega-9s. They're at the ninth position. So the omega-9 means that if you go from the methyl end of the fat, which is this end, the CH3, this part, you will go counting the carbons 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then right after the ninth one, you see the double bond. And then you go back and have the rest. So since this is 18, you'll have 9 and 9. So it's always from the methyl end that you count. Sometimes you're going to see these pictured differently, and some of these molecules could be very, very confusing. And I'll show you that in a moment. So the omegas, a few of them stand out. We don't spend a lot of time studying these, but you certainly could, as a matter of really investigating if you have a client who's not responding and you're thinking maybe there's some unusual fatty acid problem or a genetic problem. But oleic acid is the one that's most commonly used, and we'll show you later in the presentation where that's found and how much in different foods. Nervonic acid is one that I came across some very interesting research, which may play a very big role in some of our clients who are having neurological issues, slow nerve conduction issues, even things that are MS or precursors to MS. So we'll look at that in a minute, and that's a 24 carbon. They're all ones here. So let's look at polyunsaturated fats. This shows the bend. Most of the polyunsaturates, or even the monounsaturates, in the real world of three-dimensional molecules, you're going to see a bend where the fatty acid double bond is. So in this particular case, if you look, in this case, it's the opposite. The carboxyl group is on the right and the methyl group is on the left. So I could have flipped this. This is the way I found the picture. I could have flipped it just to make it less confusing for you. But I wanted you to see that at times, you really have to look, not to look at the right versus the left, but you have to look at the carboxyl side or the methyl side. So if we go to the methyl side, we're going to count to see where the first double bond occurs here. And we have 1, 2, 3. So it's at 3, which means this is an omega-3 fat. It's an omega-3 fat that has two double bonds, right? And how many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 carbons. So we have a chart later where we can look that up. So it's 18 carbons, two double bonds. The first one's at the 3. Okay, so on here you're going to see some things that you recognize, and you're going to see some that you don't. I just put them in there so that if you do see these in various documents or studies, that they won't be completely foreign to you, but I wouldn't expect you to remember any but the ones that we're really going to go through in detail. The ones that we're going to go through in more detail would be linoleic, which is one of our essential fats, alpha-linolenic, which is another one of our essential fats. They are omega-6 and 3 respectively. They're both 18 carbon fats. Then we have gamma-linoleic acid, which is on the omega-6 side. And then the next one of importance would be icosapentaenoic acid, which is an EPA, which is on the omega-3 side. Arachidonic acid, which is on the omega-6 side. docosahexaenoic acid, DHA. And we see these a lot, and these are very important fats in human metabolism and fats that you can actually manipulate in the diet. So we'll do another quick look. You see how they're bent? So you have a carbon, and it's, you know, they're kind of, they form these little diagonals. That's really the way they are in nature. The straight ones across are simply put out that way just to make it easier to read on the paper. But this is what it really looks like. So the top one is alpha-linolenic, and you can see the third on the left. It doesn't show that it's a CH3, but we're just assuming because that's the way it's listed. The third one is the first double bond, and then there's another one at 6, and then there's another one at 9. So this one has double bonds at 3, 6, 9, and it has 18 carbons. Linoleic, the other one of the essential fats, is got the first bond at 6, so it's an omega-6, and it actually has 2 double bonds. So let's talk briefly now about essential fats versus non-essential fats. Essential fats are fats that the body cannot make. They have to be gotten from the diet. And these are fats that you're going to be counseling your clients to make sure that they get on a regular basis. The two essential fats we have are alpha-linolenic and linoleic. It's hard to keep those two straight. ALA is the omega-3 and LA is the omega-6. So figure it out and understand it however you can. But let me just talk a little bit about essential versus non-essential. Essential means that your body cannot make it. It has to come from the outside. And that it's a precursor and a building block for other fats, but your body just doesn't have the mechanism to make it. And then the non-essential means that your body could make it, but as long as it has extras of the essential fats. So I've just listed some of the omega-6 and 3, 6, 9s that you might recognize. ALA, and that's found in flax seeds and chia seeds and hemp seeds and a little bit in a lot of other things, but those have the most significant amounts, and walnuts. Icosapentaenoic acid, EPA, and DHA, docosahexaenoic acid, DHA, are very important fats. EPA is important for the inflammatory pathways, and we'll go into more detail on those on the next video. DHA is important for brain function and for blood sugar management. It's a very important nutrient. Both of those are marine lipids, meaning they're found in the sea. They're most abundant in fish, but they're also found in algae because guess what? The fish eat the algae. So if you can get enough algae or get somebody to take enough algae, they can certainly get enough EPA, DHA, but they've got to take enough, and the oils tend to be good sources because they're more concentrated. The omega-6s, we have linoleic acid, and that's found in sunflower seeds and almonds and all your vegetable oils and pumpkin seeds, and it's abundant in the diet. In fact, when we look at the ratios, most people get too much linoleic and not enough linolenic. But downstream from the elongation product of linoleic acid is gamma-linolenic acid. And gamma-linolenic acid is found in things that we don't generally eat a lot of, but could be taken in supplemental form, like evening primrose oil, borage oil, black currant oil. Those tend to be the highest sources. But hemp seeds are a good source of GLA, too, that most people overlook. And then we have dihomo-gamma-linolenic acid. It's not found in foods per se. That is a conversion product. Gamma-linolenic turns into DGLA, dihomo-gamma-linolenic, and this is to take it down the anti-inflammatory pathway. When we don't have enough of the omega-3s, or we have some other confounding situations, which we look at in more detail in the inflammation video, then GLA goes down to DGLA, which goes to arachidonic acid, which is an inflammatory fatty acid. And again, that'll become very clear when we do that presentation, which is next up in this module. Then on the omega-9 side, the most predominant ones that we know about on a basis are oleic and nirvanic. Okay, so here's just some lists now. This is just for your reference. If you want to look up, you're not sure what a fatty acid belongs to, you're looking at people's stuff, maybe they've had an essential fatty acid or a full fatty acid panel done, and you're trying to understand and make heads or tails of it. and I'll share with you. A lot of these, I don't know what they are or do. We just would look them up should we suspect a problem. And if I was looking at a fatty acid test and I saw that icosa tetraenoic acid was low, other than being a direct precursor for icosapentaenoic acid, I don't know what it really is. And I don't think it's an important thing to necessarily have to memorize. So your omega-6 fats, okay, this is where we're looking at the nomenclature here. Linoleic acid, LA, is an 18 carbon with two unsaturated bonds. First one is at the sixth. There's two saturated bonds, two double bonds. Gamma linolenic is 18.3. So it's got a third one, same length, but it's got a third double bond. And it completely changes the function. Gamma-linolenic acid is oftentimes used for hormone balance, sometimes used for brain chemistry balance. Very different than linoleic acid, just by the addition of that one extra double bond and the removal of two hydrogens. Icosadienoic acid comes between that and DGLA, which is dihomogammalinoleic acid. So that's a 20 with two double bonds, which then goes to DGLA, which is a 20 with three double bonds. Okay, so they're getting longer. Next one would be arachidonic acid, which is very inflammatory and tends to push things more down towards the inflammation pathways, and that's a 24. So you can see there's not a lot of difference between these molecules in terms of what they look like structurally, but there's a huge difference in the way that they act. And you're going to find that throughout all of our studies together, that certain things, like, they look like they're almost identical, like, guess what, estrogen and testosterone. They look almost identical on paper if you just didn't see this little edge. But look at the differences it makes in our people. Huge difference. This is a chart. It may or may not be very readable on the screen, but you certainly have the printout of it for reference. And this was this has got animal fats at the top and then vegetable fats at the bottom. And it's just showing saturated, monounsaturated, polyunsaturated, and then cholesterol and vitamin E. You can see that the only things that have the cholesterol in them are the animal fats. And you'll see that in terms of vitamin E content, there's a wide variety in these fats versus the amount of vitamin E. So if you look at something like coconut oil, which has 66, oh no, that's 0.66, it doesn't have a whole lot of vitamin E in it, compared to something like wheat germ oil, which is loaded with vitamin E at 136 milligrams per 100 grams. Okay, hemp oil is pretty decent, holding its own at 12.34. The stuff that we would recommend that you take, which would be basically hemp and olive, are pretty decent in their vitamin E. None of them have cholesterol because that's a plant. Plants don't have cholesterol. Okay, so this is just a reference chart. It's more of a curiosity than anything else. So what happens if these omega-3s and 6s aren't in balance? I'm sure you've heard before, keep your omega-3 and 6 ratio in balance, but I'd like to share with you what that really means and what their implications are. And again, we'll go further into detail on the other video on the page. So that's the symbol for the Greek letter omega. And when things are out of balance, when we have too much omega-6 and not enough omega-3, we're going to push pathways down towards the inflammation side. And you'll see a lot more of that in our next part, which is the pain and inflammation with fats section. Heart disease. Okay, it's been shown to be an independent risk factor, and it could be because of the inflammation, right? It causes inflammation in the blood vessels, and that creates problem. Clotting disorders have been found to be associated with increased omega-6 versus 3. Hormonal imbalance is big time. You really need this balance of omega-3 and 6, or else you get into some inflammatory pathways and spasming pathways. And when hormone receptors get inflamed, they don't do their job and pick up the hormones. Depression and anxiety. We see so many people so many people suffering from depression and anxiety, and when we look at their fats, they're way out of balance. It's said that when you look at the omega-3s and 6s on a blood panel, you're looking to see about a 3-to-1 ratio of omega-6 to omega-3. That might be opposite of what you would think. You say, oh, omega-3s are good, why aren't they more? So just what's been found to be more optimal. So if you look at that, what we're finding, what the studies are showing, and they correlate the symptomatology with the test results, is that people who are depressed tend to have super high scores. So their omega-6 to 3 ratio might be 15 or higher. Same is true for other autoimmune and inflammatory diseases. So the idea is to nip this in the bud and to really focus on the right amount of omega-3s and 6s. It's not as easy to get omega-3s. You have to work at it. But it's sure worth the risk, or sure worth the work. Autoimmune diseases, big time, because what? The inflammatory component. Asthma, same thing. Your bronchioles get inflamed. Rashes, your body's not able to maintain balance of fatty acids, then you don't get the nice, smooth, glowing skin and flaky skin and dandruff. So let's take a look at a fatty acid lab result. We'll go way more into this. We have a whole module where we're going to talk about fatty acid testing, how you do it, what it's about, case studies, so you really get good at it, because it's a really important test. This particular one was from a lab called Metametrics, also known now as Genova, because they merged and they're together now. Let's take a look at what's shown on this blood spot fatty acid test. And this one, we call it a blood spot fatty acid test because it only takes a drop of blood. You do the same thing you would normally do if you're testing your blood glucose, which I've shown you before, and you put it on the card and you send it off to the lab. They don't have any kind of way of developing it locally yet, but so that way you could do a completely independent blood test, but I'm sure it's in the short and near term for future. So we've got the polyunsaturates, the omega-3s, and these are just the basics. This is the basic test. They have more elaborate tests, but I find that you can get so much information from this. And I'm going to give you a quick peek on what kind of information you could get from it should you want to do some of these tests. But know that we'll go into way more detail in our module further down the road. So, alpha-linolenic, where does that come from? Do you remember? Flax seeds, chia seeds, hemp seeds, walnuts. So if you've got high levels of the omega-3 ALA and you have very low levels of the DHA and EPA, which are elongated versions, then that means that you're not converting properly. So if we look at this one, this person has pretty low ALA, it's in the second quartile, and moderate EPA, which makes me think that maybe they're taking an EPA supplement, and very low DHA. Barring genetic factors, I would be guessing that this person could improve dramatically by adding some omega-3 rich foods to their diet, like flax seeds, chia seeds, hemp seeds, pumpkin seeds, deep ocean fish. There's a number of things like that, mainly because they're just plumb low. Okay. Omega-6s. We have linoleic acid, and that's up close to the end of the third quartile. We've got gamma linolenic, which is what it flows down into, and there's some cofactors in place. We'll revisit that in our section on inflammation. And on this case, we have high levels of LA. Not surprising, because linoleic acid is found everywhere. And then we've got the GLA, which is lower, which can indicate that although the linoleic is high enough, like maybe this person's been taking lots of chia seeds and flax seeds and all that stuff, and it's come up a bit, but the rest of what they want to look at is not happening. Okay, it's not converting. So you have to look at why. Is it a delta 60 saturase problem? Is it there could be an inborn error of metabolism there? More likely it's due to inflammatory components in the diet. Then we have the DGLA and the arachidonic. So I don't want to spend too much time going over this, but I wanted you to get a sense of what kind of things you can be looking for. I just want to show you a couple of examples of some fatty acid tests, like the before and after, so to speak, because this one was dramatic. This was a 60-year-old female. She was suffering when she came in with depression, and she called it bipolar. She'd been diagnosed with bipolar. And she was basically had also other issues, and I suspected that she had gluten intolerance. And we were having a little bit of a difficult time getting her convinced that, okay, go off of the gluten. So finally she went and did the Entero Labs test. And she not only did just the antibody test, she did the genetics, found out that she was full-blown celiac. She had all the genes, she had all the inflammation, she had the gluten antibodies. That convinced her. She went off the gluten, okay? But she still had, she had all this inflammatory stuff going on. So she'd been off the gluten for a while. She was improving slowly, but she still had the leaky gut to deal with. And then she had this test done. I said, let's see what your inflammatory markers are. And if you look at this, just give you a head start, AAEPA, which is number 9 down here, an ideal ratio there would be 3. Okay, 3 would be really nice. She was at 22. Okay, 22. At 22, people generally are having some serious problems like depression, MS, other things that are serious. So I told her, look, we're going to get your fatty acids changed. And she was kind of mostly vegan at the time, but she wasn't like hardcore that she had to wanted to stay that way. She was doing a lot of raw foods, and she'd made a lot of improvement by this point. Well, we had a couple of turning point moments here. We looked at this fatty acid test, said we got to get you on some fats. How do you want to do it? Do you want to do it with the chia seeds and all the other stuff? In which case I can help you, and we can help you with the cofactors. And that was before a lot of the supplements came out with the algae oil. Or do you want to do, and that's the slow path, or do you want to do the fast path? Now, I've said that to other patients before, and some of them say, well, no, I don't want to use animal products. I'm ethically vegan, and I really don't think it's even good for me as a whole. I'd really rather stay vegan. I'll say, fine, here's how we're going to do it. It's going to be slower, but here's how we're going to do it. In her case, I put her on probably pretty large doses of Nordic Naturals omegas. Because if you look at her numbers, her EPA was very low and her DHA were very low, both of them. So I just put her on a balanced formula. And I think she was taking something like 2 or 3 grams a day. She took it as a liquid. Voila, look what happened. At the end of 3 months, here she is again, well, 4 months. Okay, so in the meantime, she's telling me, wow, she's getting less depressed, her gut is working better, her joints are hurting less. Look at where she was in 3 months. We actually had to take her down a notch because she'd taken too much. This reinforces the importance of retesting, because she could have just been like one of these people who says, oh yeah, omega-3s, I'm going to take these, and she just kept taking them. She runs the risk of bleeding disorders, right? Hemorrhagic stroke if your omega levels get too high and your blood gets too thin. So we looked at her at 4 months, and here she was. Her AAEPA ratio had gone from 22.3 to 1.5. And that's a little on the low side. We really wanted it at 3. So all we did was refresh. We changed things around a little bit, and we changed her situation. But meanwhile, she was feeling better. Found some digestive enzymes that worked better for her. And it was really after this case that I started really believing in the transformation digestive enzymes as being superior to a lot of other brands, because she started on them and made a huge difference. She'd been on another brand of good enzymes, good brand, I won't mention the name, and she'd been on them for like 3 or 4 years with making just a little bit of progress. And just within 3 or 4 months, she made huge progress when she started those. And she started them independent. That was actually after this test was done. So that's the kind of stuff that you can see. And that's the importance of testing it. This is just to show you, and we'll go into way more detail, I promise you, when we get to our fatty acid module. And I'm just giving you a little tease and a little head start, but just to show you how this other test, which is a Genova full fatty acid profile, tests a lot more of those. So in addition to the alpha-linolenic, the eicosapentaenoic EPA, it tests the docosapentaenoic, so it gives you the total omega-3s there. It also tests more on the linoleic, alpha-linoleic, dihomo, arachidonic, or gamma, sorry, a couple of in-betweens, the omega-6s. But it also looks at the omega-9s, which the others don't. And as we go through the rest of this presentation, I'm going to give you a little bit of a background of why those omega-9s are important, even though they're generally considered like, you know, kind of they're not the good fats or the bad fats, they're just the neutral fats. And in fact, depending on what the situation of the person that you're dealing with, nervonic acid, as the name implies, is related to the nervous system. And it's very important in myelin sheath and in nerve cell membranes. And I'll share with you some of the ways that people can get that fat. And then this also measures some others, which we don't even think about, but omega-7s. And this thing will give us the saturated fats. And then it shows us the pathway. And the important part about the pathway here is that when we go from the short omegas, like the essential ones, the alpha linolenic and linoleic, and we get converted to the gamma GLA linolenic and down to EPA, we're elongating, we're adding some carbons onto it. And a very important enzyme is delta 60 saturase. And delta 60 saturase, we'll go into way more detail in the inflammation presentation, but suffice it to say there's a lot of cofactors, including a variety of B vitamins and minerals. And a lot of people are deficient in those because they're eating processed food. And the processed foods devoid of them, right? People are eating breads and pastas. And in the average American, those breads and pastas in various shapes and forms, including crackers and cakes and pies and all that, amount to something over 50% of their total food intake. And those have been stripped of the B vitamins and some of the fats and the vitamin E and the minerals. So we get this deficient population, and no wonder everybody's inflamed. And you have so much good you can do by helping them to concentrate on fats, not getting them on a low-fat diet, but getting them on an appropriate level of fat that provides them with the building blocks of their nervous system, their immune system, their endocrine system. So this is just a preview of what's to come, both in our next video, which we go into more detail on this whole inflammatory pathway, and then when we study in more depth those case studies. And I have hours of recorded case studies where I can share with you and teach you some amazing principles in terms of helping your clients. So I want to take a little bit of another turn, and I want to talk about other fats. So we've talked about the omega-3s, the omega-6s, the omega-9s. Those are the fatty acids. But there are other types of fats that are conglomerates of fatty acids with other molecules. So triglycerides, we hear that term a lot, right? Measure the triglycerides. We have high triglycerides. What does it really mean? Well, a triglyceride is three, right? Triglyceride, so three fatty acids and a glyceride. So it's three fatty acids and one glyceride. So over on the left, you'll see the glyceride molecule, and it's bonded to the oxygen on each of the fatty acids. Now, the thing is about triglycerides, those fatty acids could be omega-6s, they could be omega-3s, they could be omega-9s, and they could be saturated. The point is that when your body takes in fat that it or calories that it does not burn, then we need to store it as fat. So you make triglycerides. And when we measure triglycerides, if there's a high level of triglycerides in the bloodstream, that's not a good sign. That's saying that we've got a lot of extra storage forms of energy to put away, and it's not being put into the fat. It's floating in the bloodstream where it can wreak havoc on the system. Okay, so whether triglycerides are solid or liquid depends on the fatty acids. So we'll step back a moment. Saturated fats are generally going to be solid at room temperature. If you've ever gotten a jar of coconut oil and in the wintertime you have it in your cupboard, it's solid as a rock. And if you put it in your refrigerator, it's even more solid. But come summertime, when the air gets warmer and the temperature gets above 73 to 75 degrees, that saturated fat becomes more liquid. That's the coconut. Some of the saturated fats in meats and butters and cheeses actually have higher temperatures before they become liquid. And some of those are actually solid at body temperature, which some people theorize contributes to formation of plaque in the body. I believe that the formation of plaque in the body is independent of the amount of fat you have in the diet, if you indeed have clean arteries. I think that the buildup of plaque has more to do with the health of the artery linings, the health of the endothelium in there, and whether it's inflamed and damaged. And guess what? Bad fats damage it. And we'll talk a little bit about trans fats in just a moment. Trans fats are artificially saturated fats. It's where you take a polyunsaturated or a monounsaturated, but usually polys, and then you put the extra hydrogens in there to saturate it. So you cause a break of those double bonds and addition of hydrogen in there artificially. So it may be sunflower oil that looks like lard because of the extra fat. But the thing it doesn't look like it exactly is because the shape changes. So you see how when you add a double bond, you get a change in the shape, you get a bend. And you've got the cis form and the trans form. The cis form is naturally occurring in nature. The trans form is not. And when you take in fats that have been artificially hydrogenated, artificially saturated, that change in shape actually causes damage to the blood vessel lining. And it's that damage to the blood vessel lining that causes the cholesterol to stick and then attract metals and cause plaque and eventually lead to a heart attack. So we'll go into this in way more detail in our cardiovascular module. But what you're going to find as we proceed through our lessons, that I'm giving you little bits of this and little bits of that. So by the time we get to some of those later down modules, you can really focus on the particulars there. I think it's important to understand this because a lot of us go around talking about trans fats and saturated fats and unsaturated fats and omega-3s and 6s without really understanding it. And then when someone presents some conflicting information or something that's different, you don't know enough about what the structure is to say yay or nay. So that's a triglyceride. Steroids are also fats, right? Steroids are part of your hormone structures, and they're actually four rings of carbon atoms, and three are six-membered and one is five-membered. Okay, so you've got these four rings that are put together and they are considered fatty. Okay, they're considered types of fats. There's hormones like, let's just say cholesterol and testosterone and estrogen and progesterone. They're all steroid hormones, DHEA, all steroid hormones. Okay, but vitamins like vitamin D is really a steroid hormone. It's got that same structure, the four carbon ring structure at its core. And some alkaloids, which are found in various herbs, which are sometimes the active constituents of herbs, but also found in things like coffees and things that may not be good for the body. Corticosteroids are hormones produced in the adrenal cortex from these fats, and they're called corticosteroids because they're produced in the adrenal cortex. We'll go way more into those in our adrenal module. So here's some pictures of some steroids. You can see 1, 2, 3, 6 carbon rings and 1, 5 carbon ring. And they all look very similar, and the difference is these little sidecars that they have. What I wanted you to see is if we look at testosterone, next to estradiol, for example, or next to progesterone. It's got that same core. See, next to progesterone, it's got the same CH3, which is methyl group here. And the difference is at the far end, it's got same CH3 up there, but then the difference is that testosterone is OH at the end, and the progesterone is got another methyl group and an oxygen. So this is CH3O, and this is OH. So there's the extra carbon and the extra hydrogen, and that's what makes the difference between progesterone and testosterone. And you know what a big difference functionally that has. So when folks think that they can get in there and artificially saturate fats or make a drug that's similar to progesterone, like Provera, which is not really progesterone, but it's the patentable form of progesterone, they're fooling themselves to think that they can function the same. I mean, look at the difference. That tiny little difference between testosterone and progesterone makes a huge difference in function. Same thing with the rest of these guys. You can just take a look, and it's mind-boggling to look at the differences between these, that so many of them are very, very similar, yet they have very, very different functions. So these are the steroids types of fats. Sterols are steroids with an alcohol attached to the end. You see OH in chemistry is an alcohol. OH is an alcohol. So sterols are steroids with an alcohol. And they're called steroid alcohols sometimes. You can either have animal sterols or plant sterols. Plant sterols are called phytosterols. Phyto meaning plant. Animal sterols are called zoosterols. It's kind of a weird name, but animals go and live in the zoo. Study of zoology. Cholesterol is actually an animal sterol, and it's the most common and well-known animal sterol. It's vital to animal cell membrane structure and function. Cholesterol is not the enemy. And you're going to see clients who've been brainwashed to think that cholesterol is their enemy. No, it's cholesterol, excessive cholesterol, oxidized cholesterol, damaged cholesterol, that just grabs itself and hangs onto the cell walls, which causes a buildup of plaque and causes a problem. But it's the damage to the cell walls that's problematic. And usually that comes from bad fats, oxidized fats, free radicals, trans fats. And then other things, you know, like alcohol and various other chemicals and pesticides and all that, that damage the vessel linings. And guess what? We'll learn more about this in the blood sugar module, but insulin. Insulin is actually damaging to the vessel. So when people eat a lot of sugar and have a lot of insulin in their system, they're causing damage to their vessel walls, which causes then the buildup of the cholesterol, which is why diabetes and insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome are all types of blood sugar imbalance that are very prone to creating cardiac disease in people. Ergosterol, if you've heard of that, or ergosterol, whatever you want to say it, it's found in fungi, which are basically mushrooms. And it's similar to cholesterol, but in animal cells. And phytosterols block cholesterol absorption sites in the intestine and help to reduce cholesterol. So for people who are having problems with high cholesterol, they already have damage to their vessel linings, they're needing to bring their cholesterol down. You know, we want our cholesterol to be in the right range. We want it to be in that, you know, 150 to 200 range. When it goes too high, bringing it down can be helpful. There's a lot of reasons it goes too high, and we'll go through those when we get to our cardiac module. So that's plant sterols, and you will see supplements that contain phytosterols, and those are used oftentimes in the management of cardiac stuff. So this is just some pictures of various sterol alcohols, of sterols. Here's a picture of cholesterol, and you'll see that it looks rather similar in the core to some of the other steroids, and indeed cholesterol is the precursor to those other steroids molecules that we looked at before. Cholesterol has the OH, so it's a sterol, an alcohol, steroid alcohol, and it has a bunch of other more complicated stuff at the end, some methyl groups and some CH2s and CHs. Now, those get cleaved away in converting it down to pregnenolone and then the other steroid hormones. Here's some other types of of sterols, cytosterol, stigmasterol, and ergosterol. And these are the plant ones. So this is the animal sterol at the top, and these are some of our plant sterols. They're not that much different, but they have quite different functions. And these will actually bind to some of the cholesterol sites and interfere with this cholesterol, which helps in cardiac problems when people have elevated cholesterols. Here's just an overview of the cholesterol to steroid hormone pathway. We've looked at this in our overview. We looked at this in our overview module. We'll be looking at this again when we do sex hormones. We'll be looking at it again when we do adrenals. And basically, cholesterol sits at the top. It's that sterol. It gets converted to pregnenolone, and then it gets converted down to the various forms, which we saw are not that different from each other in terms of molecular structure, but are very different in terms of function. It's amazing how the body works and how people will say, oh, it's just a little change in the structure. A little change is a huge change. Next, we've got phospholipids. Phospholipids are basically fats attached to phosphoryl groups. Sphingophosphatides, including some inositol derivatives, are the backbone of sphingosine, which is the myelin sheaths. This is where some of the fats and the nervous system come into play. So what we've got here is we've got the fatty acids, which are at the tail, and then we've got those attached to some other groups. So in this case, there's two fatty acids, and those can be a variety of fatty acids. We saw that there's a lot of different fatty acids in the body, and that's what makes up a lot of the different phospholipids. There's a glycerol group, then there's a phosphate group, and then there's what's called the polar group, which varies from one of these to another. So when we look at these two different classes of phospholipids, and all of our other phospholipids pretty much fall into these classes, the backbone of the sphingophosphatides is sphingosine. The backbone of the glycerophosphatides is glycerol. So when we look at which ones fall into this, on the glycerophosphatides are the ones we're most familiar with, and you might have already heard of. Lecithin, which is made up of phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidylethanolamine, and phosphatidylinositol. Phosphatidylcholine is pretty easy to get in the diet, and you can get that through eating sunflower lecithin and soy lecithin. So lecithin is a component of that food that contains these phospholipids. Phospholipids are hugely important for cell membrane fluidity and the passage of things from one part of the cell to another. So let's look again at this in a different way. This is phosphatidylcholine. So in phosphatidylcholine, this polar group, this is the generic up here, right? We had two fatty acid groups. So here we have the two fatty acids. Then we have glycerol. And then we have phosphate, and then we have choline. So if we had phosphatidyl inositol, this choline would now be inositol. If we had phosphatidyl serine instead of choline, we would have serine. And each of those has a slightly different function in the body. Phosphatidylcholine is actually a precursor to acetylcholine, which is an important neurotransmitter, important for short-term memory and other things in the brain. Phosphatidylserine actually helps to bring cortisol levels to a stable level and is often used with people with hyperadrenal when they're in that fight-flight mode and when they're in like a stage one adrenal fatigue, which is like the cortisol levels are really high, but the DHEAs are starting to go low. And we'll review that when we do adrenals. See, what we're doing here is we're building you a base. Are you going to remember every little bit of this? No. But now when you hear something like, oh, take phosphatidylcholine, it's good for memory, or take phosphatidylserine, you'll understand, they're phospholipids, and they have fatty acids in that base, and they have glycerol, and they have phosphates, and they have choline. And you'll understand what the difference is. And you'll learn this through repeat, repeat, repeat. And it just starts to make sense if you start to read about these various compounds and how they're used in helping with balancing specific conditions. Here's again, you know, just some lists of these phospholipid molecules. The first one is ethanolamine, The second one is choline, the third one is serine, and the fourth one is inositol. So these are phosphatidylethanolamine, phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidylserine, and phosphatidylinositol. They're all the same base, the fatty acids with the glycerol, with the phosphate, and then the difference is what they call the polar molecule. And that would be the inositol, serine, choline, or ethanolamine. So hopefully I'm not losing you on this. Another group that I want to talk about, and we're close to the end here, is lipoproteins. Lipoproteins, as the name implies, are lipids combined with proteins. And there's a number of them. The reason that lipids get bound to proteins is to allow the lipids to get transported through the bloodstream. Because if you remember, water and fat don't mix well. So if you just dump a bunch of fat into the bloodstream, it's going to just clump into little balls, and it's not going to really get transported where it needs to go. So lipoproteins actually bind onto the protein that binds onto a lipid to transport it throughout the bloodstream. So lipoproteins are what carry cholesterol through the bloodstream. They carry cholesterol from the liver, where it's made, or from the diet where it's consumed, and it takes that cholesterol out to the blood vessels. Now, the cholesterol that's being taken to the blood vessels is carried by what's called a low-density lipoprotein. So that's taking cholesterol from the liver and pulling it out to the bloodstream. Usually it's because there's been a call that there's inflammation in the bloodstream, and cholesterol is important for that. It also could be because there's a call for making some more testosterone or estrogen, and we need to get the cholesterol into the bloodstream so it can then be converted. So the LDLs, the low-density lipoprotein, carry the cholesterol out into the bloodstream to do its thing, and then the high-density lipoproteins carry it back, the HDLs, and carry it out to be excreted. Now let's talk about, what does that really mean, high-density versus low-density lipoproteins? Well, before we talk about that, we'll talk about the proteins. The thing that the proteins do is they emulsify the lipid molecules, meaning they make them, they might whip them around, so now they can be transported through the bloodstream. What we're finding is that many enzymes, structural proteins, antigens, toxins, transporters of various substances, they're all lipoproteins, because that's how we can take fats and move them around the body. So, our examples. High-density lipoprotein means that it has a lot more protein than lipid. If you think about a lipid, it's a low-density molecule. If you put fat into water, it floats. It's got a lower density than the water. But if you attach it to protein, and you attach it to a lot of protein and make it a high-density lipoprotein, it's going to sink. It's going to have more density to it. Whereas a low-density lipoprotein is going to have more of the fat and less of the protein. And a very low-density lipoprotein has a lot of fat and very little protein. And we'll see a picture. This is a picture, and we've got the core of lipid, and we have a polar surface, and we have the surrounding protein. We have apolipoproteins, we have a free cholesterol, we have a phospholipid. So it's a very complicated structure. Suffice it to say, it's a combination of fat and protein, including phospholipids, which makes it real important for this transport, that carry the fat around. The more protein, the higher the density, the quote-unquote healthier that lipoprotein is. So the good cholesterol is considered HDL. So it's a high-density lipoprotein package of cholesterol, where the cholesterol is in that HDL. The LDL is the low-density. Here's a picture. So we have the high-density ones. They're a lot smaller because they're more compact, right? They've got the same amount of protein. They all have the same amount of protein. That's just the HDL has less fat. The LDL gets bigger. It's got more fat. The IDL, which we don't hear about a whole lot, the intermediate density, and then the VLDL gets even bigger, but it's very low density. So think about the ones that are very low density are huger, and the ones that are high density are smaller. And there's HDL1s and HDL2s, and we will go into more of this when we do our cardiovascular session and we talk about the VAP test, which measures this. So there's ways to measure this in your clients. Right now, we're setting the groundwork so that you basically understand. If you want to dig more into this, you know, I could do a 3-hour lecture just on LDLs, HDLs, VLDLs. You can learn more about them by studying some of the references or Google searching. Okay, so let's talk about some fatty acid tidbits. These are just little bits of information that I gathered that I thought, this is interesting stuff that was really not something that was in my awareness. Mevalonic acid is a long-chain omega-9. Remember we said most of them are between 12 and 20 carbons? This is 24, so it's considered a very long-chain fatty acid. And it's an omega-9, meaning if you start at the methyl group, which is down at the bottom here, if you start there and you count 9, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then you have your double bond. So it's an omega-9, okay? We knew that this was the methyl group, even though that was cut off on the diagram, because the carboxyl group is at the other end. Okay, and because this is the ninth position and it's an omega-9, so there's ways that you can kind of figure things out. But mevalonic acid, remember, is very important in the synthesis of myelin. We talked a little bit earlier about the sphingolipids and the sphingophosphatides and the phospholipids that had the sphingolipids as part of their matter. The mevalonic acid is an important fatty acid in those sorts of lipids. Those phospholipids that are sphingolipids would have mevalonic acid as at least one of those fatty acid chains. And if we're low in this particular fatty acid, that could be a problem with making myelin sheaths. Now, there's not a whole lot of research on this. A lot of it is theory. But there's also, we're in the early phases of really fully understanding MS and other demyelinating diseases. So I would say that one of the things you can really chat with your clients about when you're designing diets for them is really looking at the sources of some of these things and making sure that they're included. Fortunately, mevalonic acid is included in a lot of the foods that we generally tend to include in a good healthy diet. They can be used in the treatment of disorders involving demyelination, adrenoleukodystrophy, and multiple sclerosis. Those are all problems with the fatty acids. Now, when we look at where mevalonic acid is coming from, we don't really see supplements yet of mevalonic acid. The research that I saw and that I've given you references to is actually talking about that's coming. But right now, we need to focus on some of the food sources. So here are some of the food sources. Looks like king salmon is king, and that's way up at the top with 140 milligrams per 100 grams. Yellow mustard seed's pretty high, but then again, you know, unless you're really a big fan of mustard, it's hard to get a lot of that, but mustard seed is up there. Flaxseed, on the other hand, is 64 milligrams per 100 grams, but I think it's easier to get 64 milligrams of flaxseed, especially if you go with the flaxseed oil. The fatty acid will still be in the oil. Sockeye salmon, a different kind of salmon, is actually much lower than king salmon. It's 40. It's much lower than flax and mustard, too. Sesame seed is a close rival to the sockeye salmon at 35 milligrams per 100 grams. Remember that 100 grams is about 3.5 ounces. So 3.5 ounces of sesame seeds is going to be a little bit more calorically dense than 3.5 ounces of salmon, and it's going to be higher in fat, but it is a way to get, you know, you can start with sesame tahini and sesame oil and things like that. Macadamia nuts, which are quite yummy, are not as high as the others, but they're still considered one of the top sources of mevalonic acid. So if you're working with somebody and they have a tendency towards, or they've told you that they're in a remission state for MS, and they want to really get their health back and prevent that from coming back, including some of these mevalonic acid sources on a regular basis, as well as getting rid of all the trans sources, getting them on the good omega-3s that they need, balancing their fatty acid pathways via the nutrients that are required, whole fresh foods, greens, and getting them off of gluten and other allergens is going to go a long way. And adding this piece of nervonic acid stuff to the picture is something that not a lot of people are talking about. That's why I put it under tidbits, because it's not something that a lot of people are teaching. And I just happened upon it in doing the research, and I thought I would share it with you. Oleic is one of the most the abundant fatty acids in human adipose tissue. So it's triglycerides, obviously, which is the stored form. A lot of those triglycerides are oleic acid triglycerides. You can see the shape of it here better than in the picture I had earlier. And you see the shape, you know, generally speaking, we don't see straight line molecules in nature. There's little angles and bends. So this shows you the structure of oleic acid. Food sources are usually considered, olive oil is considered to be the source. And indeed, 55 to 83% of olive oil is made of oleic acid. But there are a lot of other good sources as well. 59 to 70%, 5% of pecan oil, which people don't generally eat pecan oil, but eating pecans is pretty darn good, and making pecan butter and making pecan pâtés and using pecan in making salad dressings can give you a good chunk of oleic acid. 61% of canola oil. Canola oil is not an oil I recommend, nor is peanut, which is the next one down, up to 67%. Don't recommend either of those two oils. Canola oil, because it's mostly genetically modified, and there's really no good unrefined sources of it. I think it's all rancid. And then peanut oil is generally a problem with aflatoxin, and it's also one of the only plant foods that's too high in arachidonic acid, which is inflammatory. So canola and peanut I would avoid. But macadamia nut, 60% of it is oleic acid. And we saw that a bunch of more of it is nervonic acid. So macadamia is a good food to eat. And I've listed these as oils just because that's what the chart lists them as. Personally, I think that looking at the whole food. But this is saying 60% of the oil is oleic. So then, you know, of the macadamia nut whole, probably 60 to 75% of the macadamia is fat. So there's different ways to calculate the amount of oleic in a particular product. But this is just to give you a general idea of where it's found. And then it's in lower amounts in chicken and turkey fat and lard. And then high oleic sunflower oil, which is kind of, I think it's been processed, and I don't recommend it either because it's too highly processed even in the high oleic form. Grapeseed oil, I don't recommend either. Buckthorn oil, we don't use as a culinary oil very often. It's usually used more as a therapeutic oil, and it's very healthy in the formation of hormones and in women in menopause with vaginal dryness. And then sesame oil. And remember, we saw sesame oil is a good source of nervonic acid as well. So these are foods that are very high in omega-9s, which means that they're not going to be as high in omega-6s, which means they're not going to throw your omega-6 ratios off as much. Okay, and then poppy seed oil is not something we use very much, and it's kind of low. All right, and then others are low, like if you take something like almond, it's very little oleic. Almond is going to be mostly omega-6. Okay, so I think that's it for this fatty acid. It's basically the structure, the function, the biochemistry, the different fatty acids, to give you an underlying understanding so that you really get, when we're talking fatty acids and we're talking omega-3, 6, it's not just a theoretical concept anymore, like, oh, 3s are this and 6s are that. It's really you have an understanding of the chemistry. The next video in this series is going to be about fats and inflammation, and it's going to take you through the fatty acid pathways and the synthesis of things called prostaglandins, which are inflammatory chemicals. This is good stuff for you to learn and then to be able to teach to your clients on a very dumbed down, if you will, level. Because when they understand it, when they understand what we mean when we're talking about trans fats and the way inflammation affects the blood vessel linings, they are going to be much more prone to listen to the advice that you give them and to have better clinical outcomes. So thanks for listening, and here's some references. There's more details on the site, more advanced stuff. There's also some done-for-you resources out there, and just check it out and really delve yourself into this and become the master of fats and be able to explain to your clients really the roles of fats, that fats are not something to be afraid of. They're more something to embrace and to learn how to make friends with and to take in the fats that are going to keep their bodies and their hormones in balance. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and we'll see you on the next video.